We back up for a moment and learn a little halacha about damages. If you have an animal that damages another animal, somebody else's animal, or somebody else's property, or a person, how would it be determined how much you have to pay for that? How responsible is the owner for their animal?
Totally,
no. It depends. So it depends on the kind of animal it is. If it's an animal that everyone knows is docile, like a bunny rabbit, or, you know, a kitty, or a fish, or, you know, something like that, and it's like all of a sudden your goldfish jumps out of the water and attacks you or whatever, you'd be like, I never expected that in a million years. Or your rabbit goes rogue and starts, you know, doing something, and it's like, rabbits? This is, there are some animals that can be domesticated, and they can be part of a family. And then there are some animals that no matter how well trained they ever are, remain wild animals. And if you have one of those animals and they attack and do damage, you can't say you didn't know, because it's the nature of the animal. Okay. So there are animals, and there's even within species there are animals. Like, for example, a pit bull is considered halachically to be a category of an animal that is known for attacking, even if your pit bull is the friendliest pit bull ever. So this is a thing in the American legal system, and it's a very big thing in Jewish law. So, for example, there was a story, I didn't read it, I heard about it from Rabbi Jacobson, said that there was a family, this wasn't so long ago, that had raised a chimpanzee from birth. This chimpanzee was so well trained, it ate at the table with them, it went on vacations with them, it even helped feed the horses on their property. This was a very well trained chimpanzee. It was part of the family. I don't know if it slept in the bed with them, but it was like part of the family, calm, lovely, fun, funny, etc. Until it hit puberty, and it was a male, and it became very, very aggressive and very hostile. And one day the woman was at home with the chimpanzee, and it was getting very aggressive and very frightening, and she called over a neighbor to help her put him in the cage. And the chimpanzee viciously attacked the neighbor in some horrific way that he didn't even go into, that was so horrific that he didn't want to talk about it. It's like, how responsible are those people for the damages caused by that chimpanzee? It says, 100% responsible. A chimpanzee is a wild animal. This happens in zoos. This happens in circuses, where the well-trained lion all of a sudden decides one day, you know, I'm done with being well-trained. I'll just bite your head off. This is the nature of the animal. It says things have their nature, and it doesn't matter how controlled they appear to be or how down and out they might appear to be. Their inherent nature remains their inherent nature. So what does this have to do with us, and what does this have to do with this lion here? It says, a lion that is crouching down, a lion that is lying down, is still a lion. The Jewish people, says, who's the lion? Says, what's the symbol? Who is the lion a symbol of? We see it as like, well, those who are in federation, you know, lions of
Judah.
And who is our chief representative of Judah, the tribe of Judah? It's King David. Okay, King David, that's our kingship, just as that's why it's the same. The lion is the king of the jungle and remains the king. The kingship is from the tribe of Judah, and the Jewish people are called Yehudim, from the tribe of Judah. So this lion that is being described here is describing the Jewish people, and specifically the monarchy of King David. And it's referring to it from the end, the last king of Davidic dynasty was King Hezekiah. If you've ever been in Hezekiah's tunnels, Hizkiyahu, King Hezekiah was the last of the Davidic kings. And then after that, everything went downhill. He was taken into captivity in Babylonia. That was kind of it. So that was the end of the dynasty. So it says that the lion is lying down. It doesn't appear that he's here because clearly things are not looking so good for us. We don't have a king. We don't have the Davidic dynasty. It says, this is talking about that in the future, because a lion remains a lion, and a lion doesn't turn into a pussycat or into a bunny rabbit, and even though it may have the appearance or the illusion that it is down and down for the count, mi yakimenu, who dare try to prod him and wake him up? Because in a moment, and in fact, when a lion is crouching, and even more so a lioness, because that's the one who's the more aggressive one and going out for the kill, says the lioness is when she is crouching, it's as if that is when she has maximum power, and then when she goes like in the blink of an eye and out, and that's the lioness. The lion and the lioness, that is the Jewish people. So the Jewish people, it is Mashiach, it is King David. It says, we are down, but we are not out, and no one should ever, ever make a mistake and think that there's anything other than that. The lion is the symbol of who we are. We are not symbolized by the rabbit. We are symbolized by the lion. Who is going to wake them up? Or who would dare to, like, you know, you go over, like, can you imagine, God forbid, you go to a zoo and a child sees a lion just kind of lying in the sun and makes a mistake, oh, it looks just like my sleeping cat at home, and goes over and gives it a little prod? It's going to be a big problem. It says, but we need to know this because we can say, like, oy, the lion, she's down, he's down, he's out. It's like, not happening. On the individual level, it says the lion is also our neshama. The lion is the neshama of every person. And that no matter what happens to a person, no matter what mistakes they make, no matter what wrong decisions, wrong actions, no matter what they do, and no matter what anybody has done to them. So a lion can be caged, but a lion is still a lion. A person can be hurt physically, emotionally, financially, any such way. But to ever think that this person should ever think that they are no longer a neshama or that the neshama is no longer there, then we can say the same type of thing, mi yakimenu, who will stand him up? Who will stand up this person to remind them and to convey to them how important, how significant, how meaningful, how profound, how holy, how special their neshama is. That the animal that has been caged is still an animal. And at any moment, it's not that it all this, that it needs time to even think, well, am I a lion or I'm not a lion? Well, maybe I'll evolve. I was a rabbit, now I'm acting like a rabbit, so now I'll be a cat. And then I'll be a donkey. And then I'll be a sheep. And then someday I'll be a lion. It's like, you are what you are from the get-go, and for better and for worse, but mostly for better, it cannot be changed. This is a place, I had a friend, I think I've mentioned on previous occasions, who very sadly was sexually abused by her grandfather growing up. She and her mother lived with her grandparents. He was like the deacon of a church or whatever, and he abused her. She has always been a very believing, God-fearing person, and she was fortunate enough to find a therapist who worked from her from this place, saying, you are a holy soul. It doesn't matter what anybody does to you. There is an aspect, nobody can ruin that. You are a holy soul no matter what. And it was from that place that she really began her healing. There are some animals that can be lured into thinking, but they're not really prisoners of reality. They're prisoners of their own thought. So you've heard about what they used to do. They no longer do it because now it's illegal to do this. But they used to take baby elephants when they were born, and they would tether them to a stake in the ground with a kind of a medium strength rope. And the baby would try to pull the stake out, and even though it was big, it wasn't big enough to get it out. And it would try, like, you know, 50 times, 100 times, 1,000 times, and it wasn't able to do it. As it gets older, even when it reaches its full strength, it is tethered to that stick. And it's only there because in its mind, it thinks it cannot get out. Even though in 1 second, it could pull the whole thing out in a second, but is basically imprisoned by the belief and by the training of, I was trained to experience that I can't do this, and so I can't. That kind of imprisonment is like, he forgot that he was an elephant. How dare we forget that we are a neshama? How dare we forget that we are a lion, that we are a lioness, and that we have that power to spring into action at any moment? And it's not something that an elephant, a grown elephant, wouldn't have to train to pull out that stake. But if there was a way to whisper in the elephant's ear and say, you're an elephant, that stick is like a toothpick to you, yank it out, it would be over like that. This blessing that Bilam gives to the Jewish people is the end of time saying, this is going to be what's going to happen. The lion is going to be lying down. The lion is going to be crouching. It's going to look like it's over. But make no mistake, the lion is going to get up again. The Jewish people will rise again. Says, that is our nature. To read this parsha at this time of year, during the month of Tammuz, where this weekend, the fast of Tammuz starts on is on Shabbos, but we delay it until Sunday because we don't mourn on Shabbos. But we're going to be talking about really and experiencing the beginning of the three-week period from the 17th of Tammuz until Tisha B'Av, and this period of when the lion is going to be looking like he is out, down, caged, exiled. This is, don't worry. So to have that reassurance at this time of year should be a very powerful message of inspiration and hope for each of us. Pam.
Is the image of the lion and the lamb, you know, laying quiet peacefully together, is that Jewish?
It's not this.
Okay.
Yeah, that's talking about the lion and the lamb that after Mashiach comes, that animals that are animals of prey will be transformed to no longer animals of prey. So it's a different metaphor.
It's a
different metaphor.
Than this one.
Yeah.
So what this reminds me of is that our it's so striking to me that if we take our enemies who spew venom about us currently and through time, let's just take right now, that those who are screaming the most anti-Semitic and hateful things, that when Moshiach comes, that they will be the ones that will bless us the most.
Right. And we even say that.
Right?
Yes, absolutely, because they'll know, they'll be able to see how wrong they were.
Right.
So that's why when we say Shir HaMa'alot, when we sing before Birkat HaMazon on Shabbos, and we say that the nations will say how great God is,
right,
what great things God has done for these people. It's like, why are they saying that? It's because I knew what I had in mind for them, and it so didn't turn out. In fact, it went the other way. That's amazing. And they will be able to admit it and acknowledge it. And we'll say, we didn't even know. We didn't know what you had in mind. Just like what happens with Bilam and Balak. The Jewish people were not aware at the time of anything happening. They were sitting in their tents. Balak and Bilam are on their mountaintops doing their cursing, blessing thing. And we're just living our lives. So we were not even aware of what all was going on
Now
we are very aware. But it's interesting that of how the curses turned to blessings already. Already the curses turned to blessings. You know, the BDS movement, which is trying to stifle the Israeli economy. The Israeli economy is incredibly strong. It's almost as if their curse goes into a black box and comes out a blessing. It's like, oh, you don't want people to go to Israel? Well, tourism just went up like 6 million people, or I don't know, whatever many. No, that's not right. Millions of dollars spent by tourists. It's like
billions of dollars.
How many millions? How many people went? I saw the statistics, and I don't remember what. I just saw it last week.
It was huge.
Huge number of people.
Record
breaking. So the attempts to
curse us.
The attempts to curse us and everything is, and the same thing has happened to the Jewish people when they It's like, you don't let us make money. We can't be in your guilds. You can't be this. You can't be that. You can't be in this trade. You can do this. Like, okay, we'll sell rags. And then we turn into the shmata industry, and it's like, and we run the world. It's like, everything's like, okay, no. Oh, I can have this cup? Okay, well, I'll turn this into something. And it's almost at, it's crazy. It really is crazy. And it's beautiful, thank God. But this was told to us. So this reminder is like, why did the rabbis want this to be in the Shema? Is because every day, twice a day, how often do we need this reassurance and this perspective to have? This is twice a day. And it's going to be at the times that we would associate of how the sky looks, whether we are physically lying. So you can see why did Hillel and Shammai have to have this debate about whether they're actually lying down or whether it's just at the time of lying down? It's like, it's because this says they're lying down. And it's lying down. And that means you should be lying down because you get a different experience when you lie down. It's like, well, doesn't mean when you are actually lying down. It needs to be at the time of lying down. And the time of lying down has to be at night. So, for example, our community here in Denver, many of the shuls bring Shabbos in early, which means that they have the services and you can light early and the Shabbos starts early, but it also means that Ma'ariv, the evening service, is said really before it's totally night. So the rabbis will always remind everybody to repeat, the people who come to the service, repeat the Shema after it's dark, because it has to be dark when you say the evening Shema. So you can do the whole other thing and that can be done early, but you cannot say the Shema if it's light out for the evening. And the morning Shema has to be morning. You have to be able to see. So it says, why is that? It's because in our experience of the physical world, we associate morning with hopefulness, and we associate dark and night when things are bleak. So if we're going to say the Shema and talk about ushach b'cha and lying down and when things are negative and when things are difficult, then it's going to need to be at a time of day where that message is more clearly communicated, which means I can really only think about the lion is crouching and it's a difficult time when it's actually night, and I can really only think about the future and when there will be an arising, a getting up, when it's morning and I see that the day is brightening and the new day is starting. So I have to have that experience. It's similar to having Passover has to be in the spring in the land of Israel. You have to see the world looking like renewal and rebirth. You can't have it, you know, I'm sorry if you live in South Africa or Australia or whatever, where you're like having it in the fall, but in Israel, it has to be, you see the world around you that conveys the same message. Same thing as with the Shema. Because it's not just about, oh, yes, I do go to sleep at this time. It's not about going to sleep and waking up. It's about times when I am up and times when I feel like I have been laid flat. And every day when I remind myself that I am a lion, whether I'm lying down or whether I'm standing up, whether I'm springing into action or at the moment I don't have the energy, that I remain a lion. My neshama remains intact. That is who I am. This is the message that for that phrase alone, the sages wanted to include the entire portion of Balak and add it to the Shema so that we could connect those two phrases. I don't think I'll ever say the Shema again the same. Just knowing, and you know, you have a little kid's book and it shows like the person lying down in the bed and getting up. It's like, think more broadly, think more metaphorically. So this is the future of the Jewish people. And then it makes sense to say, those who bless you are blessed and those who curse you are cursed, is because once the lion has arisen and the lioness has arisen, then all of the debts will be paid and those who bless us will be blessed and those who curse us will be cursed. So I already shared with you during Passover when we were walking to shul and the person stopped me at the construction site and said, you know, bless you, bless your people. I know what that Bible says, and it says that God blesses those who bless the Jewish people, and I just want to shake your hand, and wow. And your God is a faithful God. And I said, amen. I thought that may have been like the most spiritual thing I heard that day. No offense to anybody who did the davening, but that was a heartfelt, believed, expressed indication of I believe in God, I believe in the Jewish people, and I know what's there. And it's true. And I was like, amen, amen. That was this. And I'm not sure he was familiar with Parshat Balak, but that's what it is saying. That's what he's saying.
Evidently, there are 5 million evangelical Christians in the John Hagee's group. I'm forgetting an acronym.
Christians, Kufi.
Christians United for Israel. Kufi. And they're very strong, and they go to Washington, D.C., and whenever I'm in their presence, whether it's in their church or just meeting them or touring Jerusalem with them, I always say, I feel more comfortable with you than with a lot of my Jewish family who doesn't understand what you understand. That, I mean, they treat me like I'm a queen.
Right, you're royalty. Well, yes. So when this man said, I want to shake your hand, like it's like, you are Am Yisrael. You are the nation of Israel. It's like, it's amazing. It is such a powerful expression. It says, that's who the Jewish people are. It really is truly amazing.
I'm just curious. It's wonderful. How did you tell him you wouldn't shake his hand?
I did shake his hand. I wasn't going to get into it. We were walking to shul,
that's
and he put out his hand.
Good
and
for you, Ellen.
Yeah. I'm like, I don't shake your hand. I'm like, whatever. Yes, I did shake
your hand. I just learned so much from you and how you are on a daily
basis. It's hard to do those things. You know, if I can arrange to be, you know, like holding a book or, you know, whatever, or doing something, I do it. But I just do it. And plus, I've led my life and have evolved over time, and people know me from previous times, and you know, I'm not going to hand out my little card and say no shake now, but our kids, Benjamin and Dahlia, you know, people know that they're whatever, but they always position themselves like when they're meeting people, that if it's to a woman, then Dahlia steps forward and Benjamin just smiles real broadly from the behind, or if it's a man, he'll step forward and Dahlia will be holding a baby or something, that to kind of create an environment so that it's not such a thing, but they do not shake. They would say something very nicely, but they do not. I've just come from whatever too many places. So anyway, yes, I did shake his hand.
I think it would have burst his bubble a little bit.
I know. He's like, well, never mind that blessing. I'm not going to curse you. So
I think
you
definitely did the right thing.
You know, it was definitely not a sexual encounter. I can guarantee that there was nothing there. It was just a-okay. So. Yeah, it was fine. But this is when the Jewish people have to keep this in mind, because our history is so long and it goes through so many different stages, and it's very easy, and it's not just a few years, it's centuries. And so without a vision to hold on to, and to clearly, I mean, I think that's the beauty of metaphor, is that it gives you a picture. And it's easy to hang on to a philosophy with a picture. It's just like the lion might be sleeping, the lion might even be drugged, but it's never going to not be a lion. And when the time is right, that lion is going to come back full force, and it won't have 2 seconds to have to think about it, and that will be it. So that is the parsha of Balak and Bilam trying to curse us and having such bad luck doing that, thank God. And we should hopefully have the ability to take those blessings and really incorporate them into our own perspective, so that we have a sense of confidence in the Jewish people. Okay. Something else about Balak and going back to Balak and Yitro. So for the sake of this, I just want you to take a look at, go back to page 856 in the Hebrew. Just where it says the name Balak. So Balak is spelled Bet Lamed Kuf. Okay. So hold your hand there And then we're just going to go back for a moment also to Yitro, who we opened up at the beginning and saying, you know, that he was another person who heard about the Jewish people and how God was doing miraculous things. So if hold on page 856 and 394. It's another interesting lesson for us to keep in mind. Not just God recounting events to us and Moshe saying, oh, I want you to know this because it was really inspiring and interesting, but there's another fundamental idea for us to have, which is, again, both Yitro and Balak. Yitro, who was Kohen Midian, he was a priest, a minister of Midian, high up person, equal to like a king, and Balak, who was king of Moab, two people who are kings. A person who's a king is considered to be free. The king is the one who issues the commands. The people who are the little peons are the ones who have to follow them. So the king, the person who has kingship, sovereignty, is the one who gets to make decisions themselves. Okay? So Yitro and Balak are parallel in that way. Interestingly, Yitro is a Kohen Midian. Balak, it says, is a king of Moab, but it says he wasn't really actually a Moabite. He actually may have been a Midianite. It's kind of a little bit fuzzy of what his ancestry was. But they're both people in the kind of the same general area, the same general area. They both either heard or saw what God did for the Jewish people. The conclusion that Yitro reaches is, I need to join these people. He leaves his position, his country, his belief system, his way of life, and says, I'm done, and goes and joins the Jewish people. He had been an advisor to Pharaoh, so he was a very high up person. Balak, on the other hand, sees what God does for the Jewish people and says, I need to destroy them. What accounts for those two different reactions? Why is one person like, I don't want to know that, and so I'm going to destroy them, or I do want to know that, and I'm going to go join them? What is the reaction, the difference between I want to join and support those people because I see God, and the other is I see God, but I don't want to have anything to do with it? It's like, what is that? What is that? It says, this is the human condition. We call it the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer Tov, the good and evil inclination. It says, we make emotional decisions and not rational decisions. Yitro's decision was a rational decision, since he was the super rational thinker. He evaluated the evidence and came to a logical conclusion. Whoever this is that is causing this, this is who I want to be part of, meaning God. Balak wanted to be king and wanted to have his land and to do what he wanted to do. When we make an emotional decision, then we end up hijacking our intellect to support the decision we've already made with our emotions. This is because emotions respond instantaneously and the mind takes time. Rabbi Sacks talked about it, slow thinking, fast mind and slow mind. Our fast mind is our emotional response. Our slow mind is our intellect. Balak was like, I want to be king. I want to be in charge. I want my land. They're a threat. We have to get rid of them. He goes in that path. The other goes in the other. Both of them had an equal opportunity to come to a different decision. Embedded in their names is interesting letters that hint to us that they had both had a chance to come to the right decision. Okay. When the Jewish people stood at Mount Sinai, it was called Kabbalat Torah, the receiving of Torah. The root of Kabbalat Torah is Kabbal, Kuf Bet Lamed. The root of Torah is Torah, Tav Vav Resh Hey, or Tav Vav Resh, those extra letters there. Take a look at the names of Yitro and Balak. On top of page 394, Yitro's name, not in the right order, but the letters in his name, the second letter of his name is a tuf. The first word says parsha. The first word on the right says parsha. parshat, and then the word on the left in the Hebrew is yud, tav, resh, vav. Letters of the word Torah are three of the four letters of the word Torah are in Yitro's name. Tav, vav, resh. He had Torah, the Torah thing, because you could say, what do they know? They were just kings of these pagan places. They don't know. Why are you saying that there's any expectation that they would make the right decisions? Like, they had it in them to make the right decision. First of all, they're human beings. Any human being has the ability to make the right decision. They had it. They were kings, and God gave them in their names, which says, you have the potential to make the right decision here. Yitro. And it's funny because Yitro, that Parsha of Yitro, is when the Jewish people stand and receive Torah. This is the Parsha of Yitro, is where we stand at Mount Sinai. So his name is already like the Torah Parsha. But then take a look at Balak. Go to page 856. Balak, we said before that standing at Sinai was called Kabbalat Torah, the receiving of Torah. The root of the word Kabbalat Torah is Kuf Bet Lamed. What letters do you see in Balak's name? Kuf Bet Lamed. Okay? His name is, again, not in the same order. There they are. He had the potential to have reached the highest levels. He could have said, oh, MG. He could have said, oh, my goodness. Wow. How can I be a part of this? Especially since the Jews were no threat to him whatsoever. The Jews were only trying to go through the land to get to the land of Israel. They had already asked in last week's Parsha, they had asked the other nations, can we go through? And they were like, no. They said, well, we'll go on the king's highway. No, we won't, you know, we'll pay you for anything that gets destroyed. No. In fact, they came out and went to war with them, and the Jews defeated them. And it was a complete defensive war. Balak draws the complete wrong conclusion. The only conclusion he draws is, well, I'm not going to try to go to war with them because I'll lose. That's why he decides to go the cursing route. But he had the opportunity to have the other decision, which is lekabel. He had the ability to receive the right conclusion, but his emotional choice was no. And so he goes the cursing route. He says, this is where the Yitro and the Balak, each and every one of us, is like, don't confuse me with the facts. I already decided what I want to do. When I decide what I want to do, then I will employ my intellect to allow me to go from being rational to being rationalizing. And rationalizing is when we hijack the intellect for the sake of our emotions. And once we do that, we're gone. It's very hard to stop that process. It says we should be suspect of anything we choose to do. We really should be suspect of anything we choose to do, because we think that we're being rational because we can provide the logic for it. But the most horrific people alive have provided logical reasons for why they do what they do. Horrible things. Horrible people. Hitler, Yimach Shemo, his name should be completely erased, had completely illogical reasons why the Jews should be destroyed. It was totally logical. People are not illogical. So we say, oh, that's so stupid. People are not stupid. People are smart. And people are not primitive. People are smart. They are intellects. Their intellects are very much intact. But just because somebody is smart does not mean that they are using their intellect to support a wise decision. It's having a conversation with somebody who was saying, you know, like, kind of like, why should I be religious? She happens to live in Israel. Why should I be religious? I see all the secular people who live in Israel, and they're perfectly nice people. They're smart people. So why should I? Like, why not just live my life the way I want to? It's like, I say, okay, so you're assuming that because they're smart, that their decision they made is correct. Says, have you ever, I've never seen that actually as a correlation, that smart people make good decisions. It's not true. Wise people make good decisions, but not smart people. It doesn't really take anything. Someone said, oh, well, they're so smart. Well, so were the Nazi collaborators were incredibly smart. You have somebody who is a mastermind criminal. They're terribly smart. The people who are arranging all these hacking and all these other things, I'm happy if I can get my computer to reboot. You know, I'm smart. They're smarter, but they're doing bad things. So intellect is not a sign of anything. It's a tool, and a tool can go rogue. Okay, you know, like if I was sitting here with a power chainsaw or something like that, I could end up like destroying the whole room. It's like it's a powerful tool. Just because it's a powerful tool does not mean it's been employed in the best way. Balak and Yitro represent the two ways you can go. And there isn't a third Parav Parsha that says, well, they were really smart and they just led like this mediocre life. It doesn't happen that way. And the person who is king, it says, is to remind us that we're kings, we're queens. We are the ones who are the masters and mistresses of our own destiny. We choose what we want to do. We choose how we want to live. We have the opportunity to go either the Yitro route or the Balak route. And they will reach either one being heroic or one being a complete disaster. It's like, well, how long, when will it be a disaster? Somewhere along the way, it will be a disaster. It's like, well, it doesn't look like a disaster. I think, well, Balak, for a long time, looked like he was doing very well, and then he wasn't. So this mindset that we have, am I going to be Balak or am I going to be Yitro? Am I going to use my mind or am I going to make decisions based on my emotions? We can go the other way, too. When we make decisions and choices based on our intellect, we can then use and harness our emotions to help us enjoy the decision that we've made. So when someone says, like, so, I was trying to get this, but it didn't really work so well yet. But let's say somebody doesn't want to eat, chocolate for whatever, God knows what reason you would decide that. But you make a decision not to do it, and then there's people go through hypnosis. My husband had an aunt who went through hypnosis to keep her from eating desserts ever again, which was really amazing, and then she didn't. But they associate, they try and have like a therapy to associate the taste of chocolate makes you nauseous or something. The taste of this, it makes you sick or makes you unhappy, because otherwise the mind is going to connect whatever we want to do with something pleasurable. If we're trying to stay away from something, we have to make it unpleasurable. That's why there'll be a fine or something. If you want to do something and it's the wrong thing, there's a fine for that. There's a price for that. There's a cost for that. So that's how we have to train ourselves, because our minds otherwise are going to be hijacked to use to do the things that we know we should not do. So Balak and Yitro are our two paradigms, and we get to choose which way we're going to go. And this week, as we get ready in the month of Tammuz, we spoke about Tammuz last week, that Tammuz was this god of the god of tragedy and the god of pity and self-pity. It says, we're going to have the fast of Tammuz on Sunday, and we're getting ready to enter the 3 weeks, which is going to be a very negative and sad and difficult time for the Jewish people. And yet we are supposed to remain buoyant in spirit at the same time. And we hold these two places simultaneously. So to go back to our lion, to remember that the lion is lying down, the lion is going to be crouching. It is the time, and we're going to, as we get into the month of Av, and what's the astrological sign for the month of August? Is the lion. Okay, it says the lion may be lying down, but we also say that the month of Av, Tisha B'Av, is the birthday of Mashiach. It says, when it's down is at the time, then the only place it has to go is up. We're going to go into the month of the lion, and the lion is now resting, the lion is crouching, but it remains a lion. Our souls may be, our lives may be going through challenges, difficulties. We may have experienced things, we may have ourselves done things, chosen things, but we remain a dignified, ensouled human being of lofty spirit that can never, ever be changed. We are going to meet next week on the 25th, and then I will be with my, God willing, with my children and grandchildren, and we will resume on August 22nd. I will send out a reminder. So we're going, we'll resume next week, and then after that, we will be after Tisha B'Av. God willing, we won't have to celebrate Tisha B'Av as anything other than a yuntif. And we've talked about this before, but I'll just remind you that Tisha B'Av, which is the saddest day of the year, that on the davening that day, that it is treated as a semi-yentif. It's treated as a semi-holiday because in the future it will be a holiday. So we hold that place for, in the future it's going to be a holiday. And to be able to do that in our own lives, like, it's really difficult and painful now, but there will be joy again. We'll be moving forward with joy and things. There will be places of times to celebrate and happiness in the future. And we hang on to both of those things at the same time.
And which day is, so does it start Saturday night?
It doesn't. Good question. It starts Sunday morning before dawn. So you, it starts, like, I don't know, like at 4 in the morning.
Okay.
On
so
Sunday?
Only Sunday,
and excuse me, until Havdalah time.
Okay.
And then that. The
and
Tisha.
The class is going to resume on the 22nd of August.
Yes, but we will meet next week on the 25th. And then Tisha B'Av is a full day fast. That's a long fast. That's going to start Saturday night, August. We'll talk about that August 10th and through Sunday, August 11th. Again, because it falls on Shabbos, and so it's pushed off till Sunday because we don't mourn on. We don't have a mourning fast, M-O-U-R-N. We don't have a mourning fast on Shabbos, so it's pushed off till the Sunday. Okay, Hashem should give our lion strength, and it should be ready to jump back up, and all of us should have remember who we are and not lose sight of the fact that we are the Jewish people. It has been foretold. We've seen plenty of evidence for it, how the Jewish people have sprung back even after the Holocaust. And talk about thought we were down and out, and here we are. And it's,
we're back.
It's so dramatic. It's such a blessing. And Bilam would have to be shaking his head saying, like, yep, that's what I said. I knew that was going to happen. So he calls it here, and we're going to read it this week and have that reminder each time we do the Shema, even though we're not reading the entire Parsha, to have this in mind when we say that phrase about our lying down and our rising up. Have a wonderful Shabbos.
Thank you.